BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show has come to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to our listeners in Preston and also in South America. Tonight we have interviews with Jamers, who is singer and guitarist for Surf and Turnips, and we also have Tom Waghorn, who's owner of Waghorn Guitars. Anthea has features on Staff and Cuts at Bristol City College, and also an interview with Frank Hutton, the director of Adlib. Malcolm Grieve reads another instalment of An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, and Jeff Sparks is here with his What's On guide, and Lisa will be reading a couple of poems. My name's John Peters Coleman, and in the studio with me now, I'd like to introduce Jamers, who is the singer and guitarist for Surf and Turnips.
Hi there, hello.
Hello. So you've got a new album out. Tell me a little bit about Surf and Turnips. How long has this band been a going concern?
Right, well, we were once upon a time just your ordinary kind of run-of-the-mill punk band about 15, 16 years ago.
Right.
Maybe a bit more, actually, come to think of it. And we wanted to get it going again, and we ended up deciding to do some West Country music specifically.
Okay.
And we did toy with changing the name of the band, and we'd had a big gap again, and that's what we were going to do. We were going to do something completely new because it was quite different. But then when we thought about it, the name of Surfing Turnips, which was our original name, was also a pretty good name for a Wurzel's punk rock band who loved the Beach Boys. So we decided to stick with that.
Yeah.
So about 3 or 4 years we've been doing the West Country thing.
All right. I understand you're releasing this your new album, Return to Turbo Island, yourself. Have you had sort of run-ins with other record companies or the business, or what made you decide to do it on your own?
Well, very much coming from that underground punk rock scene, there were a few labels that we knew, and they've put CDs out for us. And that's been fine. It's been a good enough relationship.
Yeah.
However, we've been spending the best part of half a year trying to convince people to do the artwork for us because we don't have any talent in that direction, and just piecing things together.
Yeah.
And it would take at least another 6 months for these small labels to do it again, you know, to be able to finalise and put out a release.
Yeah.
So another 6 months is too long. We'll probably record again by then anyway. So we've made a conscientious decision to release it ourselves and to explore being a label.
Yeah.
And why not? Could be good fun.
Well, you've done a good job. It looks great. Surf and Turnips, how did you come by the name? Where does that come from?
Well, we did have a big list of names, actually, and we crossed loads of them off, and that was the last one.
Right, okay. So it's the only one that you could all agree on.
Well, and the other thing as well was, especially at the time, you know, we liked the Ramones, and that's very much a surf rock sound.
Okay, and the little bit you mentioned, the Beach Boys as well.
That's right, and in fact, actually, before then, I think if I go back to the earliest days, we were influenced before then, when we were young teenagers, by the Happy Mondays. You ever heard of them?
Yes, I remember them.
Yeah,
name.
So our original name was the Happy Carrots. So, okay. I don't know, Vegetable. I think... Vegetable-orientated rock again from the indie perspective.
Okay, yeah. I understand. Okay, Turbo Island, I mean, what can I say about such a beautiful place? You've got a little write-up about each of the 13 songs inside. And we'll give you a blast of Turbo Island, the track, later on. It says, "This famous island is near to our home port. You won't find it on any maps, but it is a home to many of the greatest cider drinkers who ever lived. If you can find it, send us a photograph." All your songs are about sort of Bristol or just the West Country or...?
Well, we've tried to spread the songs out over the whole West Country. Originally, the first songs we came up with were all Bristol localities.
Yeah.
And not all of them were successful. We only recorded some songs. So there was a real bias, for example, of locations around Lodge Causeway, if you know.
Okay,
right.
Is there a little bit of politics? Like, I want this song. Like, this song might be better, but this song's about this place. And we
it's just if it succeeds, that's it. It goes on the album. Some of them we just, yeah. You know, we're not the greatest musicians, and we only practice 2 or 3 times a year.
Okay.
So really, you know, if it works out in the studio, we keep it, and if it doesn't... So all our albums potentially could have been very different, you know.
Okay.
And certainly with that one there, actually, we had another 5 or 6 songs that we just threw away in the end.
You know? You play the guitar?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And do you sing?
I do as well, yeah. And we're very much now trying to get me and the other singer, Titch, we're trying to sing at the same time.
Oh, harmonies. And
yeah, yeah. And we seem to be good at doing that naturally.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just like a West Country thing that comes naturally, but, you know, it's been good, actually. There's been moments when it's brought a tear to my eye, those harmonies.
In a good way.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, just checking. Yeah. Yeah. It could bring tears another way. Yeah. Are you only practice 2 or 3 times a year? Like, that's pretty rare, really. I mean, you play a lot in your own time.
We play gigs. And at the moment, the situation is our set is mostly older songs that we've done because people know them. I mean, there's no point playing the whole new album when we play live. We played a couple of gigs this weekend, and generally, people know our songs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes sense to play them. We've practiced before that on there, before the 17 songs we did, we practiced twice and that was it.
Right.
We just banged them out. And I think the accordion player is probably the best musician and the one with the most challenging job. So he listened to it at home and come up with his
own
stuff.
He's got a little
stuff.
Bit more homework to do.
He has, yeah.
So what other instruments have you got?
It's just drums, bass, guitar. So it's like a simple rock outfit, really, with accordion over the top.
Okay.
Two vocals, and I said we just record the whole thing more or less live, really. Okay.
How'd you get on with, there are like another band that springs to mind, who's a very, very West Country Bristol band, Gurkha. How'd you get on with other bands that might be West Country influenced?
Well, the way it seems to be that everyone's, you know, in the cider scene seems to be generally, they don't come out too often, they're generally like to sit at home, you know, watching the telly. In a pile of their own vomit, something like that. I don't know.
So we don't actually.
It's like ships on the sea. We rarely pass one another in the same port, you know. But I do know those guys, and yeah, they're some of those guys. I admire their lifestyle, actually.
Mm.
You know, for me, the turnips is at times is a bit of a dream, really.
Yeah, Pig looks like he's had a little bit too much of a lifestyle.
Well, you know, he's only 23, so. You know. But I think those boys, yeah, they know how to live it, you know. They travel, they go to Europe, they travel around. Okay. And those guys really live the dream. So they're, you know, excellent.
Okay.
Good role models.
How far are your ambitions? How high are you setting your sights for surfing turnips?
Well, we don't know at the moment. See, we don't really make much money at the moment, you know. We do a lot of charity gigs, that's for sure. And then we do some favours as well. And like we played some gig the other day. Some New Age Traveller site is getting chucked out of Dartmoor.
Oh, right.
And it's right in a famous location where there's loads of pixies. So
okay.
I don't know why, but we sort of know these people. So we did a benefit for them.
It's called Tinker's Bubble or something like that, is it? There's a traveller site called that.
South Brent, these people are.
Oh, okay, right.
I don't know too many people down there. So we do stuff for free, but now, what's the next step? I don't know. I mean, the thing is, we're all working people. A couple of us have got families, you know. Yeah. A couple of very lonely people in the band as well. But who's to say? You know, to do anything more would mean commitment.
Yeah.
And, you know, life rolls on, doesn't it? So who knows? But saying that, I've got a feeling that the Wurzels, you know, they've got to be hanging up their wellies soon, haven't they?
Yeah.
And who's going to fill that gap? Because we've been doing this for a few years now, and there doesn't really seem to be anyone else. Not really.
I don't know. I mean, I reckon you could go with this, because I remember we had the guy from Hacksaw, who's another local band in,
like
a two-piece, and he said their weirdest gig was supporting, I think it was Pete Tong, at some kind of business do, like very corporate, but I don't know. If you want to make something of it, would you be willing to go the extra mile and do a bit of corporate?
Well, you know, I've... been polishing up the old banjo recently, and maybe as an attempt in the future to go less of a rock sound, you know, because, I mean, there's a lot of people really interested in us.
Yeah.
Like, for example, when we played at Salisbury at the weekend, there were people who travelled down from, like, Herefordshire, and they camped literally outside the pub overnight, you know.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's
yeah.
well impressive.
Yeah, and, like, we turned up in places, like, down in Torquay, and there's been a few hundred people, and they know every single word, including some new songs that we've never recorded, and that was quite weird. Yeah, and even practice them yet.
You've got a secret fan base that do things on your behalf that you don't know about.
Well, they don't do too much on our behalf, but they're there
and
they do travel. Yeah, so there were when we played in Salisbury the weekend. Yeah, that was cracking. There was, you know, a couple of dozen people there who travelled specifically to see us.
I suppose you've got the element. You've got some of the old audience, and you know you bring along some new ones as well. So hopefully you get a good mixture of age range.
Yeah. But I mean, some of these boys who turned up, they were like proper farmer boys, you know, like in their 60s.
Yeah.
And then there was young couples turned up, you know, camping, and yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, for the future, what to do? I don't know. We might turn more easy listening. I mean, we've done essentially, I think it's four punk rock albums now as a West Country Turnips outfit, and it's all going to be the same after a point. We're going to run out of ideas. Not quite yet. I've certainly got plenty of ideas, but yeah, so I don't know. I'll tell you what, work is tough, and if I could replace my job with perhaps, you know, three nights a week, earning a fair few hundred pounds, you know, wearing the Wurzel's wellies.
Do you write the lyrics?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Well, we all take it in turns, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where do you take, I mean, as far geographically, how far do you think you take inspiration from? I mean, Gloucestershire would obviously be within the West Country.
The Isles are silly.
The Isles are silly.
Maybe the land of Leon S. Was that further out? I don't
know. God knows, I've never even heard of it.
But yeah, all over in the West Country. I said at the moment we've got a lack of songs about Gloucestershire, Wiltshire, you know.
Herefordshire?
We've got a few about Herefordshire, you know. I'm aware of the cider West Country culture up there, you know. So, yeah, we've definitely mentioned them
Perry,
a few times.
Perry can only come from Herefordshire, I understand.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, Perry, proper Perry, can only be called that if it's from Herefordshire specifically.
Oh, right.
Maybe I've given you a... I've just got this romantic vision that, you know, you could be the soundtrack at a young farmer's disco to a young farmer's first kiss, and you'll look back in years to come and go, oh, I remember that night.
Yeah.
And play a Surf and Turnip song.
Well,
my song.
We need to break out of these urban rock venues then, in that case.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, we're not a covers band, so, you know, we don't want to just go down the route of playing specific covers pubs.
If you were to do a cover, what song do you reckon you would choose?
At the moment... I've been thinking about the Wurzels a bit recently.
Right.
And Twice Daily. Do you know that song?
No, I don't.
It's a song about love, anyway. When he's out mowing the, what they call it? Mowing, not the lawn, the hay field.
Yeah.
He falls in love and ends up with loads of babies. He gets forced to marry this woman. So there's a lot of potential there with that song.
All right.
So, yeah.
How could people get hold of this? Do you have a web presence?
Well, actually, what I need to do at the moment is... get that CD onto MySpace and make it easily buyable.
Yeah,
I'm looking for someone at the moment, if you're listening out there, to take some of these CDs off of me. Sailor Return, there's no risk.
Yeah.
And maybe somewhere in Bristol where people know they can go and pick them up.
Yeah.
I mean, preferably a record shop of some kind.
Yeah, there's
probably
a couple on Gloucester Road that might have. Yeah.
Non-corporate, you know. I haven't been down to St Nick's. I was going to go down there this weekend and down to Gloucester Road, see what can happen.
Yeah.
And I reckon all we need is three or four record shops around the West Country, you know, one in Plymouth. There's some guy in Taunton who said he'd take some.
Okay.
And that'd do, wouldn't it?
Okay.
It'd be fine.
Lastly, very quickly, what is the best cider in the West Country today, do you think?
Right. Well, you know, this is a very political debate, actually. And I think, from my point of view... I really like Thatcher's Cheddar Valley at the moment.
Okay.
However, we do meet a lot of cider purists, and indeed we've met the cider police as well recently, who are into scrumpy and pure scrumpy, unpasteurised scrumpy.
Right.
And they would probably lynch me for saying that, because Thatcher's is pasteurised.
Okay, yeah, and very quickly, because we are overrunning a bit, you got a gig on Friday, July the 3rd, at the Reckless Engineer, which is right at the bottom of the road that leads up to Temple Mead Station. Who else will be performing on the night?
All right, whereas Hacksaw, you mentioned them earlier. They are classic. Brilliant.
Yes.
Alien Stash Tin, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but they are cosmic band.
Yeah.
Very looking forward to playing with them.
Okay.
There's the Dreadnoughts from Canada, who are one of these Celtic punk bands, big scene at the moment, and they seem to be really infatuated, is that the word?
Yeah.
Ooh, I was going to say infatuated, but that's different.
No.
Well, with cider in the West Country, so we're going to see what those boys do. They are amazing. And then there's the Surfing Turnips as well.
Brilliant. So, I've got to end it there, but thank you very much for coming in. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, come and see us, folks. Goodbye.
July the 3rd.
Plea. Oh, won't you marry? back. I searched off a slope's gruff point and off the old bear pit. But now that we've found the place, we'll drink like lunatics.
Whoa, raise the lid, said whoa.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Staff from Bristol City College were demonstrating outside the council house last week against cuts in staffing levels. No surprise that there being staffing cuts, unfortunately. Reporter Anthony Page was there to record their discontent at the proposals.
Caroline Vowles, UCU Union City of Bristol College.
I'm Joe Brown, UCU Union City of Bristol College.
Why are you outside the council house with placards?
We're outside the council house with placards because the management of the college are trying to make about 15 people compulsory redundant in a very short space of time.
Why?
They don't feel they've got sufficient funds to employ sufficient staff. Relative to the number of students they have coming through. So they're sacking some staff and downgrading others. Meanwhile, we do find that the top level of management increased 25% in the past few years on higher pay. We believe that savings could be made there. So we've got placards about trips to China, which cost a lot of money to get a few students in. We'd like to see savings made at that level. We've got the college employing marketing and consultants, experts, and we think savings could be made within the college, staff could be redeployed, and they could avoid compulsory redundancies.
So how do you think the council will help?
We're here at the council because at the moment we're funded by the Learning and Skills Council, which is a separate body which takes taxpayers' money into the college for the students. This is folding up during this year, and this time next year the City Council will be in some shape or form responsible for some of the funding, if not all the funding, coming through to the college. We will be under their umbrella, so the quality matters.
We also feel that the Council clearly has a very strong mandate to look at the quality of education in this city, whether it funds it or not. And clearly, if your plan is to take teachers away from the classroom in terms of redundancies and continue building the management team, we as a union fail to see how that's going to improve quality of teaching and learning, which is what the college is there for.
Would it make any difference, the change of council to your course? From Labour to Lib Dem?
It's very hard to say at this point. We're out lobbying the council, and it's their first meeting today. So some of these new councillors, I think it's their first day at work as a councillor. We're hoping that certainly new councillors that are coming in will kind of see some sympathy with our calls and begin to ask questions, both at cabinet and council level. We also hope that we've brought some students with us today, and that those students are going to contact their particular councillors, and those new councillors will, you know, come with a renewed energy, perhaps, to start pursuing some of these issues around quality in education, especially in further education.
Do you think this is happening nationwide?
Oh, yes, it is.
Absolutely.
Yes, it is.
We've already heard of 8 colleges, and I'm sure there's more that are facing compulsory redundancies in terms of teaching staff, whilst management doesn't seem to face any redundancies or downgrading at all.
Are they blaming it on the credit crunch?
In terms of the recession, it's a difficult one. I mean, clearly funding streams have changed very much and are continuing to change, and the public purse is deemed to be very tight. I mean, the one thing I would say about recession, of course, is that education is one of the most important things that we keep going throughout recession. We need people to train, we need people to get skills to have jobs when they come.
Actually, cutting public services in a recession would only make it worse.
Can you just give us your name?
I'm Pete Wearden, yeah.
What's your role?
Well, I'm a teacher, City of Bristol, yeah. Anybody cutting, if you cut public spending in a recession, you'll simply make the recession worse because people have less to spend and it'll exacerbate the downturn. In fact, what you need to do with public services is increase the spending on public services in a downturn so that you bottom the downturn out, so you bottom the recession out. In the upswing, public sector workers tend not to get big pay rises and bonuses, but on the other hand, in the downswing, it's important to keep public services going. And what we trade for is we don't get big, massive bonuses in the upswing, but we expect some level of security and our pensions in return. And actually, public services limit the depth of a recession, and the very worst thing to do in a recession is to cut public services.
But isn't the worst thing about this that Bristol City College actually train people for very useful professions like...
Yes, they do.
Beauty therapy, hairdressing,
plumbing, building.
Yeah, a lot of the jobs that the universities don't touch.
Indeed,
real void.
Yes, we do.
For young people who maybe don't come from wealthy backgrounds, don't have wealthy parents, and need that sort of training to get them out of the bottomless pit.
Yes, and retraining as well. We take quite a lot of adults back through retraining, and there has been funding from central government, increased funding this year, announced in the budget for 16 to 18 into further education to provide training so that people are not on the dole queue for a considerable period of time. And we're trying to find out where these funds have gone, because we believe we've got more money coming into the college. And that's the backdrop to compulsory redundancies, which to us it doesn't add up.
You know, we take a significant amount of vulnerable people within the college in terms of training. People with English as a second language, people on very, very low or no income. People who, as you say, wouldn't have access to university, often won't have access to A-levels within schools. And in terms of the teaching we offer, we provide a very important service for the City of Bristol, and getting people upskilling and into employment. And we feel in recession that's even more important.
So what about lobbying the MPs in Parliament?
We are all writing to our individual MPs to make our case. Whether we'll get a lobby to Parliament together, we haven't quite got that far yet, but we may do.
We're certainly contacting our individual MPs and Stephen Williams, who is the MP for the area at which the college is in, so the central area in Bristol. So see if he can take up our calls. We're hoping to meet Stephen Williams at the end of this week to discuss this further. We shall see.
Well, good luck.
Thank you very much.
That was Anthea Page talking to staff from Bristol City College. Now we have some music, and this is Django Reinhardt with Body and Soul.
Thank you.
In the studio with me now is Tom Waghorn, who's owner of the Waghorn Guitars shop, studio, whichever you will call it, which is based right here in Bristol, in fact, right above my head, in fact, because our studio is in the basement underneath you. Hello.
That's right. Hi there.
How long have you been... you are a luthier, is that
correct? A luthier.
A luthier.
Is the correct term, yeah.
Okay. How long have you been doing this?
12 or 13 years now.
Okay, you look like quite a young gentleman. You must have started at an early age.
I did. Kind of started 18 or 19, I guess. So, yeah, pretty young.
Okay. How long have you been sort of running your own business now?
Well, I've been in business... this is my 10th year in business, because I started in 2000. Seems like a very long time.
Okay, so that was your early 20s then, I guess, you started your...
Early 20s, yeah.
Yeah, it's really young to start. Obviously, I'm assuming that you hadn't run your own business before, and this was
nope.
a completely new venture.
Yep.
What did you do to go about running your own luthier business?
Well, complete mistake, really. I mean, I actually kind of went to art college after school, got pretty disenchanted with that, and actually took a year out, and actually got a job in a music shop. Do you know Hobgoblin on
yes,
Park Street?
Yes, I do, yeah.
I worked for them for... 5 years, and met another luthier who was kind of repairing all their instruments for them at the time. And mm-hmm. I went to his workshop one day with some repair work and just thought, wow, what an amazing job. And we badgered him for a while to get him to teach me. And after a few months, he said yes, as long as I took the repairs away from him, because he was getting pretty sick of those anyway.
Right.
And so I got into it that way. Never dreamed of it before, but yeah, what an amazing job.
How are you finding running a business in this credit crunch, a ubiquitous term, but how are you finding it's actually affecting you?
Not at all, strangely. We're busier than ever at the moment, which is quite bizarre. Absolutely flat out.
I guess, as long as people need instruments, you're always in business, really. Has it always been that way for you?
I guess so. I mean, it's strange at the moment, because I would have thought, actually, that buying a guitar was a luxury. But... I guess a lot more people are having their guitars repaired and set up, but in saying that, actually, I've taken a lot of orders recently as well. But it's just about getting your name out there, really, and kind of building up a reputation.
Yeah. How much? What is your ratio of doing sort of acoustic to electric? Do you make both? Do you?
I do make both. Mostly acoustics. I mean, currently I have about 10 acoustics on order, which will last me well into next year. And I've got sort of half a dozen electrics on order as well. It's about half, I don't know what you call it, a third electrics, I guess, as opposed to two-thirds acoustics.
So how are, not being an expert, and obviously what makes acoustic guitars that look the same different from each other, I mean, how much individuality do you put into a guitar that you make as opposed to somebody different who makes a guitar that, to me, looks pretty much the same?
Sure. First of all, it's kind of sound quality. That's the big difference. I mean, the big brands kind of have a sort of sterility about them, if you see what I mean. They kind of... Their advertising campaign will tell you that they're the best guitars in the world, but actually when you play them, they're pretty average. A lot of people that will try one of my guitars will actually notice the sound quality straight away. And then what they'll think about is kind of what woods they'd like, what kind of decoration... and maybe a bit of personalisation, some inlays, that kind of thing.
Okay, what kinds of woods do you source, do you think about using, and where do you get them all from?
Well, for the soundboard, I always use European spruce, which is Norway spruce or Swiss pine.
Okay, is that the... that's looking at guitar, the...
that's the front
the
of
front
the guitar,
is.
Yeah.
Okay.
For me, that gives the best sound. There are other types of spruce, some a bit more rigid, tighter sort of sounding. The European spruce is a lot more flexible. It's the sound that I like to get. You get a lot of depth from it, a lot of bass and warmth. Back and sides, popular one, Indian rosewood.
Right.
It's in the name, really, from India. The other popular woods, things like American black walnut...
Yeah.
Maple, mahogany is still a popular one, although it's very difficult to get hold of. So I use quite a lot of reclaimed mahogany, some old shelves, old tabletops, that sort of thing. It's quite nice. The neck is always mahogany. The fingerboard, again, things like rosewoods and ebonies and things like that.
And on, can you sort of inlay different kinds of woods into each other at all? To
you can do. I mean, generally we kind of inlay sort of mother of pearl work, if you see what I mean.
Okay.
So if somebody wanted something a little bit different, they could have their initials inlaid into the fingerboard or on the headstock. Sometimes I've kind of copied their signature and inlaid that in mother of pearl as well. You know, rather than actually wood inlays, but. The guitar is kind of decorated with what you call purflings and bandings, which are kind of wood decoration.
Okay. What kind of genres or... I'm just wondering how to phrase it. Sort of music, I mean, in terms of people who come to you for a guitar, I mean, do you get people who play all different kinds of music, or do you get a lot of folk asking for your acoustics? Or
all sorts, really. I guess a lot of my customers actually are probably... 50s or 60s, you know, looking for their dream guitar.
Okay.
More so than young people, but yeah, you know, folk players, fingerstyle players, but rock and blues as well, you know.
What about your electric guitars? I mean, if it's sort of electric, presumably, and you don't have to have a sort of a hollow inside it, what goes into your thought process about sort of the wood that you use for that? Is it just sort of how
sure.
it looks?
A lot of it to do with is how it looks. I think... again, with electrics, you can buy lots of big brands. People are quite happy with those. If you want something a little bit different, you know, something that looks different, something, again, that has a bit of personalisation, then that's when people come to me. Woods-wise can colour the sound a bit, but I think it's a lot to do with the actual electronics in it.
Okay. We had Steve Treble from Treble Rot in.
Oh, yeah.
We had him in twice, actually, and he made an attempt to run his business online. Have you tried doing that?
No. Probably busy enough, actually, not to have to worry about that at the moment.
Okay. How do you feel about sort of the internet business and sort of buying... If somebody wanted to buy a guitar off you sort of online, what would you think about that, trying to do business online?
Right. I prefer it to be a sort of more hands-on approach, really. I like to be able to speak to the customer and mm-hmm. kind of talk. We can talk through woods and we can talk through inlays and the size and the shape and the sound that they're looking for. Online, it's kind of... I don't know how to explain it, really, but you wouldn't get the choices that I'd be able to talk to through with the customer properly, if you see what I mean. It's
yeah.
to explain, but I mean, people have been on the website and have contacted me through the website or contacted me through email, but very often I like to get on the phone, really, and kind of talk to them personally.
How long does it take to train to become a luthier? I mean, there are some professions which, I don't know, a little bit like airline pilots, where you have to invest an awful lot of your own money and time
sure.
in order to get there. How easy is it for somebody who likes playing the guitar to think, I wonder what it takes to actually make my own?
Right. Well, I kind of had an old-fashioned apprenticeship personally. It took me about 5 years, 4 or 5 years to train. But that was kind of once or twice a week. You know, not full time, but there are college courses that you can go on. I think there's one up in Leeds, one down in Totnes, and they're kind of intensive courses. Possibly some of them 6 months, a year, or 2 years. I'm not really sure, but again, quite expensive.
Okay, what kind of music do you like to play on guitars?
Well, personally, I'm kind of a bit of a heavy rock man, really. I kind of like my early 90s sort of grungy stuff.
Yeah.
So I like playing the electric. More so than the acoustic, really.
Mm.
But I kind of learnt a little bit of fingerstyle stuff, a bit of sort of Celtic sort of stuff a little while ago whilst I was sort of selling guitars for Hobgoblin music. Yeah, a little bit ropey now, though, unfortunately, because a little bit too busy in the workshop. Don't get much time to actually practice these days.
Okay, so you don't sort of play out, don't get to play out live as much as you would like?
Unfortunately not, no.
Do you ever give guitar lessons at all, or do you just stick with just making and repairing guitars?
Just making and repairing. I mean, I work 6 days a week and fairly long hours.
Okay. How many people have you got up there working with you?
I've got two guys working with me. Simon Bamber, who's doing all the setup work. He's been with me now for well over 5 years. And I've got Dylan Humphreys up there, who's doing most of the repair work and refrets and refinishing work and stuff like that. But also he makes his own guitars under the Demoness brand, sort of metal-style guitars.
Okay, right, so you've got a pretty good range. I mean, what sort of competition do you reckon you've got in Bristol? Or, I mean, I don't really know any other people who do luthiering in Bristol.
Yeah, Not a great deal. I mean, there's Johnny Kincaid up in Cottam. He's been around a very long time. Phil Davidson, who was the chap that actually taught me, he makes guitars, mandolin family stuff, banjos, etc. And there's Paul Shippey, who's a mandolin maker. I'm not sure if he's making guitars, but there's a few of us out there, but I don't really see it as competition.
Okay, have you made yourself your own sort of dream guitar?
Yeah, I've got an electric in the workshop, which is a demo model, and that kind of was my dream guitar.
Okay.
It's a bit battered now, it's been there a little while.
Okay, so take me through a little bit through your sort of dream guitar.
Well, kind of much on my sort of musical tastes, really. It's got a kind of fiery look to it in the finish, and sort of very black around the edges, dark looking timbers and stuff. It's a great guitar, a bit of a rock guitar, really, heavy rock guitar.
Yeah. In terms of like the famous shapes, like you get the flying V and sort of the classic sunburst shape, does it make a lot of difference to the sound particularly, or is it just...
It can do. I mean, a Les Paul, for instance, is quite a heavy guitar, so people associate that with sort of sustain. The Flying V, I couldn't really pinpoint its particular sound, but I mean, a Strat, for instance, a Fender Stratocaster would have a particularly different sound from a Les Paul, but you could associate that with the pickups more so than the woods and the shape.
Right. Okay. So there are other factors. What have you ever sort of experimented with any sort of completely crazy shapes or whatever, or do you tend to stick to some that...
I'm pretty safe, to be honest, I've got to say. There are makers out there that do their own shapes, and it's hard to pull it off. It's difficult, I'd say, to kind of come up with a shape that you think people are going to warm to. So I tend to stay safe. My designs are different, but not too different. They're kind of vintagey with maybe a slight more modern twist.
Okay. In terms of like when you paint an electric, and they often have a sort of a glazed or plasticated sort of look to them, that gloss, how do you get that?
Well, basically, it kind of depends on how you're going to finish the guitar, but you need to sort of base coat the guitar first to fill all the grain. If you're going to colour it, obviously, then that would be the next step after the base coating.
Okay.
You can either add the colour into the lacquer, or you can add the colour directly onto the wood before you base coat it. But you kind of need to seal the colour in before you top coat it. And the top coat would be like your final sort of gloss finish.
Yeah.
But there's lots of rubbing down and lots of coats, you know, involved in that. Lots of man hours.
Yeah, I do remember reading an article about violin making, and sort of some famous sort of really expensive violin players use like only a sort of tiny spoonful of amount of a particular kind of lacquer on it, because they say like even a millimetre more will change the sound or whatever. I mean, do you kind of measure the amount of?
I do with the acoustics. I aim for about 0.2 of a mil thick. With the electrics, I'm not so worried. Obviously, again, because I think it's more down to the electronics in it. But with the acoustics, if the finish is thick, it could sort of inhibit the sound a little bit, for sure.
I mean, I suppose, what do you think about sort of the technology and in terms of electric guitars? Do you think there is anywhere... What do you think the new possibilities for electric guitars are? I mean, we've got, obviously, the amp... You know, you plug your amp in, you've got the amplification, you've got the knobs on... Is there anything else, I mean, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of amp modelling guitars out there. Basically, they have a lot of electronics on board, which you can flick a knob or a switch and basically replicate amp sounds, different amp sounds,
right.
Things like that. Quite complicated, but sort of, I don't know, I guess sort of they're more computerised, really, than guitars. But, you know, they're great.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in. And just a reminder, you're on Mill Avenue.
That's right.
Just off Queen Square. You don't really have a website presence as such, but how could sort of people get in touch?
The website?
Yeah, I do have a website.
I do have a website, yeah. That's www.waghornguitars.co.uk. Or you could give us a call on 0117 927 2111.
927-2111.
That's right.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for coming in and having a chat.
No problem. Thank you.
you're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's time for Malcolm Grieve to read us another part of An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Comfortable Words, continued. We had today the most delicious pork ever eaten. To two hesitants were there. No R in the month. I replied that there was an R in Fothergill, which was supposed to, and did, reassure them. The parting words of St. John Irvine after staying here, and being ever so kind with Mrs. Irvine for 3 weeks, just as he was getting into our old horse bus for the station, were, "I don't like Tame, and I don't like the people." So I replied, "We must stay with Milton. The mind is its own place, and can make a heaven of Tame, or a Tame of heaven." Perhaps he didn't like them because the people here avoid strife. Where else would you get a sweet in a 4-shilling lunch that costs 4.5 a head? It doesn't seem much, but in other and expensive places it would cost 1 3 farthings or less. There must be a specific innkeeper's love for his charges. Or perhaps it's the same as a hospital nurse's. It's little that one can do for them. But I believe a constant watching tells its tale over against the inertia of the innkeeper who wants not to keep the inn, but the inn to keep him. I'm sorry, I cannot allow myself to indulge in a saintly sadistic love of the often disagreeable and conceited commercial traveller, lest he come again and disturbed by his incongruity. His hat on the pictures, coat over the sitting-room chairs, and leather bags beside writing-tables. But one afternoon we melted towards a poor fellow travelling for something in which he had done no business, and missed the last bus. We had him to tea, and he told us about his children. At 7:30 I took him solemnly into the dining-room and asked him to sit down, and gave him dinner and wine, and waited on him in an amusing roomful, and sent him away pathetic in his embarrassed gratitude. I am so tired. My affectation of styling myself publican in official and other documents must stop. I had to explain on the telephone to an insurance office that I was not my own barman, in order to save paying a much higher life premium. A patronising or perhaps well-meaning woman said, "You ought to do well here. It's supposed to be the best hotel in town." I replied, "Well, we don't fear competition in Tame, but there is indeed a hotel a few miles east of Baghdad, which is giving us a little trouble at present." Probably she is still going around saying that she had been talking kindly to an innkeeper about himself at Tame, when he suddenly started talking about Baghdad. A young lady, of whose hypochondriacy I had been forewarned, told me on the first morning that she hadn't slept at all. I said, "What a privileged person! Because to most of us it is given to enjoy lying in a lovely bed for only a few minutes in the morning, just when we ought to be getting up. It is as if we were unconscious throughout the whole meal and only woke up in time for the savoury." And I quoted a poem of mine, which I once used to good purpose on myself when in like condition. "Oh, what some power the gifty gie us to flee ourselves as others flee us." 1926. The signpost goes up. I told the auctioneer, who, like the rest here, is sniffy and grudging of our new signpost, that it alone will bring into the town £40,000 in the course of the next 10 years, which is putting it low, and he sniggered. The original sign, when I came, had merely the name of the hotel, with luncheons and teas. In 1923 I sketched out the eagle on it, and Carrington Partridge painted it beautifully. Spencer Hoffman did the beautiful lettering. It used to hang out from the house 15 feet over the parapet on iron bars and tie-rods upon which Timms, blacksmith of Long Crendon, when 22 years old, mounted his beautiful ironwork in 1834. After 92 years of swinging and vibrating, the part of the house where it was fixed was getting disintegrated. So in the summer of 1924 I wrote to the council asking permission to put the sign up on a post on the pavement. which they wouldn't have the power to do had I not told them that it would take the place of an ugly lamp-post, which I would light at my own expense. The council came in force to interview me on a summer evening at 8 o'clock outside the house, when dinner was in full swing and I was in a white duck dress suit, and it began to drizzle. I was given permission. I showed my half-inch drawing to the late H.J. Bernstingle, who suggested two important refinements, e.g. the lead cap and the lanterns, for which he gave me full-size drawings. Later, the post was published in an architectural journal, crediting Bernstingle with the general conception and details, and me with being a good innkeeper. Fortunately, I had working with me Mr. Cook, ex-shipwright Lieutenant R.N., who, besides shaping and fluting the post in the backyard, helped Eton in the erection of it, and was the real genius and sine qua non of the post's existence. Ralph Timms of Tame adjusted and added to his grandfather's wrought ironwork to fit the frame, which he also made. My chief difficulty, in which I had really no help, was the strength and fixing of this huge iron frame, so I wrote an apologetic letter to Dorman Long, Battersea, and they replied that our local blacksmith should be well able to devise, and that they themselves were unable. How kind we English are to one another! So I had to do my best. The sign, frame and ironwork, measures 10 feet square, and the height from the ground is 23 feet. It was Mr. Cook's idea to slightly taper the 4 feet in the ground and drop it into a fitted cast-iron socket, so that it will, as it shrinks, always keep tight. In order to give another 15 inches depth, one Lanyon, engineer and rubber planter who was staying here, suggested dropping from the corners of the square plate at the bottom of the tapered socket 4 15-inch rods with flat plates on the bottom of these. So the footing is now 5 feet, which Mr. Howland surrounded with 3 tons of concrete. Afterwards I started making out the cost, and gave up when I reached £190. When he saw it up, Mr. Robinson, the surveyor, was very nervous, as it was a much bigger thing than the council ever anticipated, which was more like this, he said, kicking a scaffold pole. What, he asks, what would they do if every publican and eating house in Tame asked to put up a sign? I told him if they could find lamp posts to replace with signs, it would be much to the good. This evening, Spencer Jackson, good old man, iron and brass founder and inventor, came in and said he'd proposed me, and I'd been elected, with acclamation, a member of the Chamber of Commerce. And now the brewers of the Black Horse next door have hung a new sign against their house, a black quadruped, printed on beaver board. But as the other side is only a reproduction of this, the animal is seen walking into the house by the upper window, giving its hind quarters to the street. Ipos melampuyos.
Thank you to Malcolm Grieve, as ever, for reading an innkeeper's diary by John Fothergill, and obviously I hope in future series we continue to be able to display his talent.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Insider, which is the name of the leading creative business magazine for the South West, held a panel event at the Assembly Rooms in Bath. Our next feature is from Dialect's reporter Anthea Page, and it's an interview with Frank Hutton, the founder of Adlib, a creative recruitment agency. Frank was at the panel event and he opened the meeting.
I'm Frank Hutton.
Where are you from?
I work for a company called Adlib, that's my company. And we've been in existence since 2001, finding roles for creative people here in the West.
So why did you set up your company? Was there a niche in the market?
Well, it was kind of by accident. I'd already got into recruitment, having worked in advertising and marketing for most of my life. And I just had a number of my lovely friends coming along and asking me, Frank, help, can I find a job? Or Frank, help, can you find me a person? And who was I to refuse? Just a few phone calls later, before I knew it, I had a business on my hands. So Adlib was born.
You had a big network of friends in the business, basically.
Basically, it's about networks, about people. It's about understanding how to put the right people in the right place. It's a bit like a dating agency, so it's slightly more complex.
Adlib. Yeah, where did you get the name from?
Adlib was a very quick thing. We wanted something that described some of the industries that we were serving, like advertising, but I also wanted something that was very near the beginning of the alphabet, so in all the listings we were easy to find, and it began with A, and it just kind of popped out.
So you're based in Bristol.
I'm based in Bristol.
Yeah. How many people do you employ?
There's now 8 of us, and we're probably the largest agency of its kind in Bristol, well, in the whole West.
They're bringing work to Bristol, basically.
That's the idea. We bring people and work to Bristol. We like to see people coming out of London, from Manchester, and often from around the globe.
So have you noticed an exodus from London in the last few years?
Not for a little while, and things have slowed down recently because of the housing difficulties, which are prevalent in everybody's minds, probably, if they're trying to move right now. It's very difficult to sell a property and make the move. But some have succeeded, and we're still glad to welcome good quality professional people here from all kinds of creative industry backgrounds.
And what's the most popular job that you find, you know, for people?
The people we need the most of at the moment are involved with digital creativity. In other words, anything that appears on a screen. Guys who do amazing things with computers. Websites, definitely. Viral games. Anything that involves interacting with a screen these days, and probably, yes, online. And that's the biggest growth area still. And there's some serious skill shortages in that area as well.
Would that be good for graduates coming out of college to go into that field? Would that be a good place for them to find work?
Thankfully, it's a popular type of course at the moment. And yes, indeed, a lot of them coming out of universities around the region, including Bath, are finding good first homes here in the West. But too many still think they've got to go to London to get the right kind of experience. They don't. Great companies here. They can stay on their doorstep, stay somewhere sane and pleasant, still hang out in the same bars as they used to, and enjoy a great career at the same time.
So what's your website?
Our website is www.ad-recruitment.co.uk.
That was an interview with Frank Hutton, the founder and owner of the creative recruitment agency AdLib, based in the Southwest.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Jess Parks is here with this for another edition of What's Going On. Nice T-shirt, very simple, Bristol. Tell us what's going on.
Thank you. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, July the 3rd, and Surf and Turnips will be headlining the Reckless Engineer in Bristol with support from Canadian folk punk group The Dreadnoughts, who will be making their UK debut. Also on the bill is Alien Stash Tin and Haxel. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Also on the 3rd of July, Larry Miller will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Cable Co. This group hail from Glastonbury, and to date they have released 3 live albums and 2 studio albums. This is from their second album, titled Scene Mistakes, and it's a song called Invisible.
Just invisible, can't you see me?
That was at Cable Co. with Invisible from the album Same Mistakes. For more information on them, you can check out www.cable-co.co.uk. Moving on to Saturday, 4th of July, 65 Days of Static will be performing at the Thekla in Bristol with support from Let's Talk Tactics. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on 4th of July, Cabaret Rat will be performing with support at Space 72 in Bristol. Doors open at 9 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. On to Sunday, 5th of July, James Morton and the Lunatics will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. The gig starts at 8:30 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Tuesday, 7th of July, Warrior Soul will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol with support from The More I See and also Isolation. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance and £6 on the door. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
That's the end of this week's Dialect Radio show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre. Our features were brought to us by Dialect Radio reporter Anthea Page. Malcolm Grieve read excellently another instalment of An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Thank you to James for coming in and Tom Waghorn. Thank you also to Lisa Braden for reading some poems. So just a reminder, the Surf and Turnips new album, Return to Turbo Island, you can check them out on MySpace, and they're gigging on the 3rd of July at the Rex Engineer. The What Song was presented by Jess Sparks, and Village Church Curran was the studio engineer. This week's show was produced by Jess Sparks, and you can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Also, if you want to join in, just come watch what we do, get a feel for things. If you want to contribute, send us an email, bristolradiocoop@hotmail.co.uk. The no dash, it just reads Bristol Radio Coop, if you like. It's goodbye from all here at the Dialect team. Take care of yourselves.